The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with nature. And there's a picture of a, looks like a pretty tall young man, probably in his early 30s maybe, and an older woman who's got his arm around her, and it's Grandma Joy and Brad at Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota. And the title of this article is Adventure of a Lifetime. A grandmother and a grandson find a way to mend their broken relationship a national park at a time. Avoiding people in a small town requires the skills of a spy. So Brad Bryan moved like a ghost, taking precautions to stay far away from the woman who had broken his heart. He had not seen or spoken to Grandma Joy in 6 years. Brad, 27, had returned to Duncan Falls, Idaho, he's a little younger than I thought, where he was born, and raised only because he wanted to enroll at Ohio State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Already paying off student loans, Brad needed to save money to make a series of upper-level chemistry and physics classes at a local college before applying to vet school. He lived with his mother in his childhood home and worked nights as a waiter in a local restaurant. He was halfway through his evening shift when he felt his cell phone vibrate. It was his mother. His younger sister had announced her engagement and a wedding that had been set for Duncan Falls Church. Brad's heart sank. He loved his sister, but there was no way he'd attend the wedding Grandma Joy would be if Grandma Joy would be there. Despite Joy Ryan's first name, there wasn't much joy in her life. She grew up in a home with no electricity, running water, or plumbing. She attended a run-room schoolhouse, engaged at 16, and married at 18. She had her first child, Brad's father, at 21. Two more boys followed, both of whom met tragic ends. Her youngest son died of a drug overdose. The second passed over from brain cancer. She was a housewife, sold Avon products to women in town, and babysat for other mothers. When kids moved out of the house, she took a job behind the deli counter in a grocery store. By the time of the wedding, she was 78 and a widow for 14 years. She was content, but lived a small life that stopped at the edge of the county line. Other than a vacation to Florida and a trip to see relatives in Louisiana, Joy had never traveled far from Duncan Falls, a town that for most of her life had only a single traffic light. So she felt blessed when her oldest son and his wife moved nearby and had a baby. "Brad was my first grandchild," she says. "He was at our house all the time." Grandma Joy's firstborn son was a hunter and a star high school athlete. His son did not follow in his footsteps. Brad wanted to hold animals. "My earliest memory of her when I was 3, says Brad. "We walked to Blue Rock State Park, which is close to her house. She'd help me lift rocks in the creek to find crawfish. We'd hold them in our hands and talk about how beautiful it was being in nature. No one else in my family thought like that." As he grew older, Brad, who later became out as gay, was a victim of teasing and bullying. He felt alone. Grandma Joy was the one person in his world he could count on. By the time Brad left for college, he'd grown emotionally distant from his father, and ultimately they had no relationship. His parents split and then divorced. It was then that Brad learned that his father had been having an affair, and that Grandma Joy had known and never said a word. In 2002, Brad came home from college to confront his father. When he arrived, he found Grandma Joy by his father's side. The two men argued. Brad remembers his father grabbing his arm and verbally threatening him. Brad turned to his grandmother, hoping for help or just to get a kind word. He got neither. "I yelled at her," he says. "I asked her how she could be proud of this man as her son." Grandma Joy remained impassive. "I was shocked," she recalled. "I didn't know what to do." "That was the end of my relationship with Grandma Joy," he says. Over the next 6 years, he'd come to accept it, and he no longer thought about it. And then, the wedding. He considered leaving town, but he didn't. It was his sister Big's day. Of course he had to go. From where he sat in a pew, Brad saw his grandmother, thin and gaunt, walk unsteadily into the Duncan Falls Church. She had not been well, he learned from her friend there, and was barely able to stand. Brad reluctantly walked over to her. "I was surprised to see him," says Grandma Joy. "He gave me his arm, and I took it." The two didn't say much, just a few pleasant words. No hug or smile to show they were kin. They were simply two people attending a wedding. "This was not the venue or the occasion to contend with the demons in our relationship," Brad says. "I simply wanted to get her to her seat." Brad went through the niceties. He posed for family pictures and made the rounds. but he knew he was moving on, getting away from Duncan Falls. He'd always wanted to hike portions of the Appalachian Trail, and in February 2009, 6 months after the wedding, he did just that. The isolation on the trail, the physical and emotional demands, turned out to be a spiritual experience. His thoughts were his only companion, and he found himself thinking about a lot about his grandmother and the time they spent at Blue Rock State Park looking for crawfish. It puzzled him why that memory in particular stayed with him. In 2011, after getting his master's at Ohio State University, he returned home to visit his mother. He decided to call Grandma Joy. It would be their first real conversation in nearly a decade. She invited him over. "I answered the door, and there he was," says Grandma Joy. "I didn't know what to expect. What did he want? Was he still mad? It had been so long. I'd given up on ever seeing him again." She did what came naturally to her. I gave him a big hug. They walked into her kitchen. "It was familiar yet strange," says Brad. "It looked the same, but I was looking at a woman who had aged." They made small talk. Brad said she looked good. Her health, she said, had improved. Then an awkward pause. "I needed an icebreaker," said Brad. "I asked if she wanted to go to Blue Rock State Park. It was a bit of a walk, but she told me she stayed and stayed walking on the cemetery grounds behind her house." On the way there, Grandma Joy admitted she had many regrets in her life. One of them, she says, was that aside from this state park, she never had the chance to see what she called the great outdoors. When they arrived at the creek, the special place, where long ago they'd searched out the crawfish, a loud splash broke the silence. The tail of a massive beaver gliding below the water surface. Stunned, they both laughed. "We looked at each other," says Brad, "and we both realized we were still the same people." Brad left Duncan Falls and by September 2015 was deep in the rigors of veterinary school. Between grueling classes, lab work, and shifts in the school's veterinary hospital, he was feeling stressed. He needed to step away from school. Then he thought of Grandma Joy, Blue Rock State Park, and her sadness of not seeing more of nature. "I was overwhelmed," he says, "with what I perceived would be a lifelong regret if I didn't reach out again." He came up with an idea even he knew was crazy. On his next free weekend, he'd make the 400-mile trip from the veterinary school to Duncan Falls to take Grandma Joy on a camping trip to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, located on the border of North Carolina and Tennessee. Brad knew it was impractical. Grandma Joy was 85. To get to the park, they would have to drive 500 miles through the night. It would be the first time in her life she camped and slept outdoors. He called his grandmother and filled her in on his outlandish proposal. In the long pause that followed, Brad expected, for all the right reasons, she just wasn't practical. The old lady surprised him by asking, "When do we leave?" They arrived at the campground around 1:30 a.m. in the middle of a rainstorm. Brad scrambled to set up the tent. Finally successful, they climbed inside. Grandma's Joy air mattress kept deflating. "Brad would get it filled up, and then I'd slip off," she says. "It was like a Laurel and Hardy movie. I got to laughing. Then Brad got to laughing. It felt like when he was little and we did everything together." The skies cleared the next day, and Brad asked his grandmother if she felt like making the 3-mile hike to reach the bluff. They set off. She slung the cables when they crossed a ravine and avoided slipping on the wet trail. She moved with the pace of an 85-year-old woman, looking at coupons while moving down the aisle of a grocery store. People passed her, and Brad asked if she wanted to turn around. "I'm getting up that hill if it kills me," she told Brad. When they finally got to the top, the 20 or so hikers there gave her an ovation. That night, they made a campfire. He and his grandmother sat next to each other, feeling the warmth and looking at the stars. Brad and Grandma Joy opened the lockbox of their past. They talked about families and parents, about loss, pain, and regret. They told each other they'd wasted too many years being estranged. They talked about Brad's relationship with his father. She told Brad she understood that he felt she was siding with his father, but also said, "I'd feel bad if I died and didn't have anything to do with my son, too. And I told Brad I loved every bit of him." Brad realized his grandmother might not have the introspection necessary to understand how the past had affected him, but he knew now his grandmother loved him and he loved her. And that was enough, he says. That night in the tent, Grandma Joy reached over to touch Brad's hand. She knew that back in Duncan Falls, her friends were watching TV and complained about aches and pains. "Here I was, in the middle of nowhere, with my grandson," she says. "I thanked him. I had tears in my eyes, but they were good tears." The camping trip over, Brad dropped his grandmother at her home and returned to school. He graduated to a job in New Hampshire in an exotic pet veterinary practice. But in the quiet moments, he found himself thinking about a way for Grandma Joy and him to do it again. I wanted her to see Old Faithful, walk among the giant redwoods, and experience sunrise at the Grand Canyon, he says. The United States has 63 national parks. He and Grandma Joy had crossed one off the list. Brad thought they should next go to Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming. While looking at the map, he discovered that Badlands National Park was in South Dakota. I was amazed, he said. We could drive just a little farther and see two parks. Then I saw that Grant Teton National Park was right next to Yellowstone, and Glacier National Park is not too far away in Montana. Brad became obsessed. I began calculating the distance to drive from one park to the next. In 28 days, they could visit 21 national parks in South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, Washington, Oregon, California, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, and Kentucky. He called Grandma Joy. He told me we would stay in that tent again, said Grandma Joy. We'd be driving all these miles. She was 88. What more did she need out of life? This trip. And I'm going to go back here for a second, but the article still has a bit to go, but I want to describe some of these pictures. There's a picture of her in front of Old Faithful Geyser. There's a picture of her and Brad in front of a giant sequoia. I mean, you talk about a big tree. That is a big tree. And there's a picture of them on a trail in the Great Smoky Mountains. That must have been the hill she had to go up. And there's a picture of their whitewater rafting in Alaska's Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. And above, California's Channel Islands National Park. And she actually looks like she's piloting a boat while they're on the thing. And then there's the picture of her in the Badlands National Park in South Dakota with the ragged, rugged Badlands behind her, and her arms are widespread as she's holding them out. Grandma Joy and Brad have now visited 62 national parks, logging more than 50,000 miles on his car. The difference in her ages made no difference. He doesn't change the way one beholds the incandescent glow of Zion National Park's Vermilion Sandstone Cliff at sunset, she says. Grandma Joy's favorite stop was the Katami National Park in Alaska to watch the annual salmon run at Brooks Falls. More than 35 bears were trying to catch leaping salmon, fattening up before it was time for them to hibernate. The most thrilling experience I've ever had, she says. I chuckled when I watched one smart spare stay in the back and wait until another guy got the fish. Then he ran over and took it away from him. And there's a picture of her standing on a bridge looking down at the bears doing their thing. Traveling far from Duncan Falls was life-changing for Grandma Joy, who once thought an adventure meant walking into the woods to pick flowers. I've seen things most people have never seen, she says. I've seen things I didn't know existed in this peaceful world, in this beautiful world. The open road also provided the time for the pair to share their life stories. I learned about his school, says Grandma Joy, operating on animals, what he saw on the Appalachian Trail, all those things I never would have known about. She, too, had her own surprises to share. Her first job out of high school, she told him, was as a telephone switchboard operator in nearby town. She admitted that she had some of her co-workers sometimes eavesdropped on the line when calls were routed to the local house of prostitution. She recounted a wealth of dirty secrets that had remained locked in her brain for 70 years, says Brad. Grandma Joy even spilled names. I laughed so hard I came close to driving off the road. Brad says he's learned a lot traveling with his grandmother, the most important being that life is about choices made. At any given moment, we all face a choice, he says. What you choose now, what you choose can lead us on a new path. For Grad, it began many years ago when he decided to go to his sister's wedding, knowing we'd have to see the woman who had once caused him such pain. Now they're not just traveling partners, not just a grandmother and grandson, but friends. They plan to visit the last park on the list, the National Park of America, Samoa, sometime in 2023. And then, Canada, says Brad. That country has 37 national parks. And there's a picture of them sitting on a stone wall, staring at the camera, smiling. Boy, she sure doesn't look like she's 88 years old. Brad and Grandma Joy finally take it easy across Hurricane Ridge in Washington's Olympic National Park. Drama in real life. The exotic dancer versus the terrorist. Using her wits and guile, she helped capture some of the most dangerous men in America. And there's a picture of a blonde woman. Looks like she's probably maybe in her 30s, early 40s, wearing blue jeans with a real fancy belt, a temple blue tank top, and a fancy wristband. Looks like some sort of an Indian bracelet. And she's practicing in the woods. Rebecca Williams always dreamed of fighting crime like her father, who was a cop and a Baptist minister. Living in a rough suburb of Phoenix, Arizona, with her divorced mother, she spent much of her childhood binging true crime TV shows and confronting bullies. I put myself in situations that most people wouldn't, just wanting to do the right thing, she said. Then things changed. At 15, Williams fell in love with an 18-year-old grocery store manager. She dropped out of high school and they moved in together. At 19, she gave birth to a daughter, Amanda, not her real name. Amanda was deaf, autistic, and unable to talk. The young parents scraped by with odd jobs until 13 months later when they had a son, and money got even tighter. Williams began working as a cocktail waitress at various nightclubs. With a glamorous Farrah Fawcett hairstyle, she looked like a sailor's dream, said a neighbor. At Tiffany's Cabaret, she jumped on stage during amateur night and was quickly promoted to exotic dancer. She loved the thrill of transforming each night into Stevie, after Stevie Nicks, of course, a blonde bombshell who whizzed around the pole to AC's DC's You Shook Me All Night Long. Men were obsessed. And there's a picture of her in her alter ego, and she was really quite attractive. She spent her tip money on batteries for her daughter's hearing aids and still longed to fight crime. In 1999, after 14 years together, the couple separated. Fearful that the school system was failing Amanda, Williams enrolled her in a residential home for deaf children, see her only on weekends. By 2003, she was cleaning toilets to pay the bills and living with her teenage son in a double-wide trailer. Her brother, known to all as Crusher, lived in a smaller trailer in her backyard. And there's a picture of him, too. He's got a mustache and round face. Pretty nice-looking, pretty good-looking guy. Crusher, however, was a career criminal who, after selling drugs to an undercover officer, had agreed to go undercover with the Hells Angels. One day, federal agents came to visit Crusher and noticed Williams. His handler asked me if I was interested in undercover work, she recalled. It sounded cool and sort of sexy, you know, the whole spying game. She would not wait long for her first assignment. On February 26, 2004, in Scottsdale, Arizona, Don Logan finished his lunch and strolled back to the city's Office of Diversity and Dialogue. As a black man in a predominantly white city, Logan said his job as a diversity director was to create an environment where diversity is valued and encouraged. It was 1 p.m. when a colleague at reception handed him a curious package the size of a shoebox. Logan carried the box to the second floor and asked his secretary, Renita Leonard, for scissors. When he opened the box, he heard a loud pop. Time slowed as floor-to-ceiling windows shattered, debris fell from the ceiling, and a room filled with smoke and screams. Logan thought he'd been shot. Through blood-stained glasses, Leonard watched Logan stagger to the board, gushing down his arm. After an ambulance raced Logan to the hospital, doctors fought to save his forearm using skin grafts and screws. Soon the crime scene was crawling with investigators. Leading the inquiry was a pale, 40-year-old man with curly hair tinged with gray, Tristan Moreland, an agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the ATF. Moreland's team brushed fragments of the pipe bomb to the U.S. Postal Inspection Service lab in Dulles, Virginia, where experts discovered it was made from a hobby rocket motors and igniters that were impossible to trace. But there was one clue. 5 months early, someone had left a warning on Logan's answering machine. Incredibly, the caller left his name. This is Dennis Mahone. The wide area in resistance is standing up. And there's a picture of Williams, a.k.a. Becca Stevens, with white supremacist Daniel Left and Dennis Mahone in front of a Confederate flag. Dennis and Daniel Mahone are twins from Illinois, as Moreland later told the court. They began their white supremacist career as members of the Grand Dragons of the KKK. Before joining the wide area in resistance, they're into all kinds of causes, anti-abortion of white children, anti-tax, anti-government in general. Dennis was an associate of Timothy McVeigh, who detonated a truck bomb outside a federal building in Oklahoma City in 1995, killing 168 people. A serial bomber himself, Dennis, in a 1994 interview published online by an anonymous blogger, admitted, in South Florida, 83 or 84, I did some pretty serious bombings, pretty serious shootings. We also did some major activities against abortion clinics. Dennis and Daniel, who both worked as aircraft mechanics, had access to the tools to make bombs. But Dennis had an Achilles heel. During the Oklahoma City bombing investigation, the ATF planted a female confidential informant, posing as a skinhead, to get close to him. Dennis was smitten and boasted to her about his terror activities, yet it was not enough to arrest him. Moreland planned to send in another CI, that's confidential informant, to see if Dennis would brag about the Scottsdale attack. He needed a woman who was not only alluring, but also brave, because the mission could be fraught with danger. In January 2005, the ATF summoned Williams to his Phoenix office. She lived a little in life, she has a lot of street smarts, and she's run with some rough crowds, Moreland recalled, thinking after they met. She had an edge and would be believable. When he told Williams there had been a bombing that seriously injured a black person, she was intrigued. And there's a picture of Dennis Mahone in his green Grand Dragon outfit. What a ridiculous thing. It was an honorable thing to do to save lives, Williams said. She signed an agreement to become a CI in exchange for $100 a day and up to $100,000 if the Mahomes were convicted. A neighbor agreed to watch Williams' son, and she was on her flight to Oklahoma. On board, Moreland gave her cover story and a driver's license in the name of Becca Stevens. She was a woman on the run from the law, a white nationalist. Williams would have to transform into a very different person. While Williams was a caring person who, growing up, was taught that everyone was a child of God, Becca Stevens hated everybody of color. They drove from the airport to an abandoned Walmart where a trailer attached to a blue Dodge truck sat. Inside the trailer, a light switch above the stove turned on pinhole cameras in the ceiling, covering every part of the trailer except the bedroom and bathroom. The trailer transmitted live audio and video to a nearby hotel room, where ATF agents lay in wait. An audio recorder was hidden in a keychain that swung from Williams' belt. Moreland introduced her to Shelley, a brunette ATF agent who would play her friend. I was like, okay, this looks like it's going to be fun, Williams recalled. As she and Shelley drove toward an RV camp, Williams was buzzing. There was an adrenaline rush going for sure, she said. Williams had no idea that it was just the beginning of a grueling 7-year ordeal to bring the Mahones to justice. No one could know what she was doing, not even her family. It didn't take long for the Mahone brothers to notice two attractive women parking their trailer with a Confederate flag hanging in their window next to theirs. Daniel offered to hook up their sewer and water connections while the dentist cracked jokes. The brothers were 54 years old and shared the same goofy smile. Dennis, 3 inches shorter, was more dominant brother. He told me that he was a Grand Dragon of the KKK, Williams recalled. To prove it, he showed her a photograph of him wearing a green ceremonial hood. In another image, he performed Hitler's Sieg Heil salute. Williams invited the brothers into her trailer and flicked the light switch, which triggered the recording device. Soon they were chatting over beers and booze. Daniel boasted about drive-by shootings and blowing up cars. We were just trying to send a message, he told Williams. Williams, hoping to captivate the men the way Stevie did customers at the strip club, stayed quiet, even standoffish. Dennis was smitten. I just want to cuddle with you. You're so beautiful, he told her. Your day may come, she teased, steering him out the door. Hidden microphones later recorded Williams as she whispered, weirdo. After 3 days of hanging out with the brothers, Williams told Dennis that she was on the run and had a warrant out for her arrest. Breaking down in fake tears, she confessed that she had tried to bomb a child molester's car in California. Moved. Dennis touched her arm. I want to hurt him real bad, she told him. Soon ATF devices recorded Dennis telling her how to send a bail bomb and blow up a car using a condom and liquid explosives. Days later at a gun show, after Williams asked if he'd worked on bombs, Dennis whispered, yes. The diversity officer, Scottsdale, had his fingers blown off. Then he caught himself and said he had told white cops how to do it. After 12 days, Williams left the campsite, telling the brothers that she needed to keep moving to evade the law. She promised to ride and drove away, with Shelley pulling the ATF trailer full of secret video footage. Returned home to her children and her life. But the job wasn't done. The ATF wanted more evidence. In May 2005, she and Dennis were frequent pen pals. She continued the flirtatious behavior. In December, mailing a Christmas card with a suggestive photograph. Thought you'd love the butt shot, she wrote. Dennis's love language was hate. Med Helium's books called Creative Revenge and Manual of Urban Guerrilla Warfare. In May 2006, Dennis suggested that she meet Robert Joes. Joes ran an extremist training camp in rural Missouri, as well as a church, the Sacerdotal Order of David Company, where he preached apocalyptic Christians. Joes, a former Eagle Scout and Air Force Academy cadet, was on parole after serving a 2-year sentence for driving without a license, a felony because it was a third such offense. He claimed he answers to God and not the government. Earlier, Jose is spelled J-O-O-S. Henchman had tracked down a Missouri State Trooper who had arrested Joe and shot him through his kitchen window. Joe's was untouchable. He's a brilliant guy. His IQ is well above mine, Moreland says. No cops could get into his remote compound without risking an ambush. But for a $100,000 reward, Williams was willing to go into the belly of the beast. It was January 2008 when Williams drove to a Sonic Burger in Joplin, Missouri to meet Joe's. He was easy to find, wearing prayer beads, a long beard, and a royal blue bandana holding back his long gray hair. He looked like Charles Manson. "It's been a while since I've had a lady around to open a door for her," Joe said when they reached a rental car. When William drops into a curtsy, he blushed. Joe's called out directions as Williams weaved through the country roads to Joe's 200-acre church compound an hour away. Because of the remote location, ATF surveillance was impossible. She was going it alone. No backup. Morland had told her to wear a pink ribbon in her hair to help aerial teams identify her. They arrived at a large gate. After she drove in, he locked it behind them. "At that moment I realized, I am truly in the grace of God," she recalled. They drove through a graveyard of broken-down cars, inside rickety buildings. Williams noted several long guns as they strolled among the walnut trees. Joe's taught her how to make napalm using household soap. Joe's told her deeper into the woods, showing her caves where he had supplies. He said if he ever found out that somebody was trying to infiltrate them, that they would disappear, she said. She thought about her keychain, seeking and recording them, and imagined her dead body decomposing in a cave. She wondered if the pink ribbon was to help agents identify her body. In 2008, the Mahones announced they were headed to Arizona, and Moreland hashed a plan to get them talking about the Scottsdale Palm. "I provided her a traffic ticket court notice from the city of Scottsdale," he later recalled. Williams asked the twins to drive with her to the courthouse, next to the bombing site. When they passed the building where the bomb had exploded in Don Logan's face, they both automatically flinched and ducked down into a fetal position, Williams recalls. Daniel said, "That's where Logan's from." Before Dennis repeated his previous assertion to Wilson, "Williams, I didn't plant the bomb. I helped make it." Later, the ATF recorded a rattled Daniel telling his brother that Williams had an agenda. She was certain she was compromised. Next day, Williams appeared at the brothers' hotel wearing a Confederate flag bikini that seemed to lift the fog of suspicion. I guess it would. Dennis talked about how much he loved Williams and how he wanted to settle down with her. He talked about raising Williams' son and teaching him to hunt. In September 2008, Williams wanted to quit. Her 3 years as a confidential informant had taken a toll on her family life. It was exhausting, lying to her mother and her teenage children. She hated being away from Amanda, and she couldn't relax. At any moment she might have to snap into character, chatting about the New World Order. Even her relationship with Morton had begun to fray. "There were a lot of heated arguments," Morton said. "I think she might even have punched me a couple times." As of January 2009, Williams had gathered hundreds of hours of video and audio evidence that linked Dennis Mahone to the Scottsdale bombing and proved that Robert Joes was stockpiling weapons. But Moreland wanted more. He would accompany Williams back to the compound, but this time as his alter ego, Jimmy the Wolf Foster. "Jimmy's a hardcore extremist," said Moreland, packing 10,000 semi-automatic rifle that would give him instant credibility with Joes. "I told him I was with a small cell in Arizona," Morton later told court. "My affiliations were with the White Aryan Resistance. I dealt guns. I messed around with explosives. The ruse worked. I was ultimately able to get Joes to teach me how to build a bomb that was going to be used in a fictitious bombing." Joes had fallen for Jimmy the Wolf's story, and Moreland was invited to join the Order, a murderous white supremacist group. "I got hired by the Order to kill Judge Richard Match, who was the judge in the Timothy Vail trial," he said. In April 2009, Williams drove Moreland to meet Dennis and Daniel at their home in Illinois. The brothers also fell for Jimmy the Wolf routine. "Don't put a swastika on a synagogue. Bomb it if you want to do something about it." It was just one piece of advice Dennis gave Moreland. When they passed an outbuilding, Dennis said, "This is where I make my bombs." Moreland was satisfied. With all the evidence that he and Williams had compiled, there was no reason to put things off any longer. It was time to stop the Mahons. At 7 a.m. on June 25, 2009, armed ATF agents surrounded a Mahon house where Daniel and Dennis were caring for their ailing mother. Agents smashed down the doors, handcuffed the twins, and ransacked the house. They found high explosive, improvised bombs, assault weapons, ammunition, bulletproof vest, a Nazi armband, and a photo of Osama bin Laden inscribed, "Our Hero." When Jimmy the Wolf read them their rights, Dennis said, "We knew. You and the girl, we knew." With the Bahans, Joes, and other associated white supremacists arrested, Williams could finally turn to ordinary life. She took a job at a motorcycle rental store in Flagstaff. On July 4th, she rode in the store's float on a parade. As the band filled in the national anthem, Williams thought of the terrorists she had put behind bars and smelled with pride. That night in Chicago, Dennis Mahan sat in a jail cell and confessed to his cellmate that he had planted the bomb that injured Don Logan as payback for the city of Scottsdale's firing of three white police officers. The Mahan's trial began in January 2012. While the district attorney showed proof that Daniel wanted to pop and cap Don Logan, his lawyer argued that Daniel was just a braggart who was not involved in the bombing. The court agreed, and Daniel was found not guilty of any crime. Dennis was found guilty on three counts and sentenced to 40 years. For the prohibited possession of firearms, Robert Joes received a sentence of 78 months in prison. He can never again legally own a weapon. Tristan Moreland retired in 2014 and is now a drummer in a band. "It worked out in the end," Moreland said about his work with Williams. "She was fearless." The ATF recommended Williams enter the witness relocation program for her safety, but she refused to cut off contact with her children. Instead, she bought a trailer and vanished. When I tracked her down in June 2022, Williams was living with a man at an off-the-grid property she bought with her ATF money. Solar-powered security cameras often captioned them brushing their ponies or making ice cream from their goat's milk. At night, behind reinforced doors, they often throw dance parties. Amanda has a speaker, and she likes to hold it and feel the vibrations, Williams explained. Williams revealed that she's volunteered to investigate a cold case, a mysterious double murder in a nearby ghost town. She thinks she can use her skills as an undercover informant to solve the case. "The police have come to a dead end on this, and it's because they haven't done any field work," she said. "My dad still thinks I should become a detective." Interesting article. Very interesting and brave lady. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. Protect your home inside and out. Extreme weather, broken pipes, theft, and more can all add up to expensive problems. Here are the smart security products and preventive measures that can help you safeguard your biggest asset. Plus, the best and worst homeowners insurance companies from CR's exclusive survey. And there's a picture here of a couple on a front porch of a, this is a drawing, not a picture, it's a, an artist's rendering of a house. Tree limbs threatening your roof? What to do to prevent pricey problems? Gutter stuffed with leaves? Take action against overflow. Car an easy target for thieves? Five simple deterrents. Punch porch pirates on the prowl? The best video doorbells and security cameras. Worried about fire, leaks, and mold? Smart smoke and CO detectors, thermostats, and leak detectors. Need to secure doors and windows, CR's top do-it-yourself security systems, locks, and more. Your home is a lot of things. It's your sanctuary. It's an expression of your personal style. And financially speaking, it's likely your biggest investment and asset. So, of course, you want to keep it structurally safe and its context well protected. Security, however, may mean managing a number of complex variables these days, from flash floods to wildfires, from break-ins to porch piracy. According to the Insurance Information Institute, 6% of insurance households submitted a claim in 2020, the most recent year studied. Property damage, including theft, accounted for 97.7% of homeowners' insurance claims. The average claim rang in at over $13,000, reflecting the severity of most of these incidents. Fortunately, there are many ways you can reduce the odds of enduring a loss and having to file a claim. Inside your house and out, using both the latest tech tools and time-honored techniques, you can protect your home and enhance your peace of mind. Consumers can be more prepared and resilient, whether by installing a home security system, understanding their area's environmental risks, or updating your insurance policies, says 3i spokesman Janet Ruiz. There's an array of ways to take control. Here we share the latest thinking on just how to do that. Protect your home from the outside. Rain, snow, sleet, hail, and heat waves can all take their toll on your home. And sometimes a critter or even a burglar may attempt a perimeter breach. Fear not. It doesn't take a massive amount of effort or a huge investment to protect your place. With a bit of planning and some smart prep work, you can keep your property in prime condition. Inspect the roof. Leaks tend to be a major issue, and fixing damage to the surface of the roof or the rafters can cost a bundle. A new roof costs on the average of $9,000, more if the roof rafters need replacing. You could try to spot potential problems with binoculars, but that won't tell you the full story. And please, no climbing on the roof yourself. A proper roof inspection involves checking five zones: the home's interior, attic, perimeter, exterior, and the rooftop itself, to look for existing and emerging issues, says Paul Rotros, president of the National Roof Certification and Inspection Association. This process identifies where moisture might be seeping in, any cracked, curled, or missing shingles, and issues with flashing around skylights and chimneys and vents. Though you may see contractors offering free inspections, Watchers cautions that these can come with a hidden price. If they're doing a free work as a potential first step to paid work, he says, you know what you're getting into and check the company's references. An alternate route: pay an NRCIA licensed professional. Search by zip code at nrcia.org/nrcia-member-directory to perform an annual inspection. For a 2,500-square-foot house, this is likely to take about an hour and cost around $400. If the roof is in good shape, you can add a roof certification for 2 years at about $350. While this won't cover damage from hurricanes and other acts of God, if your roof leaks for other reason, the repair will be free. Clean those gutters. If your gutters are packed with fallen leaves, pine needles, and other debris, water can cascade over the edges and seep inside your home, causing damage. If the wet mass in your gutters freezes during bitterly cold days, ice dams can damage the gutters and prevent them from routing melting ice and snow. Getting your gutters thoroughly cleaned once or twice a year costs about $160 per cleaning. This is the national average. Actual costs can vary depending on your location and the size of your house. Flushing out the downspouts could add $50 to $100. Or you can install a gutter guard system between $100 and $2,000 for 200 feet installed, depending on the material you choose. Steel mesh is considered top-notch. This offers fire protection benefits as well. Seal up possible leaks. In addition to keeping your roof in good shape, consider having a qualified contractor caulk and brace roof soffit vents to reduce the amount of water blown into your attic during hurricane-force winds and rain. While you may be tempted to caulk your windows, proceed with caution, says Kirk Clausen, remodeler's chair of the National Association of Home Builders and Owners of Clausen Remodeling in Ossipee, New Hampshire. Except for homes with wood windows, you probably have composite window frames which need to move and contract as the temperature changes, he says. You don't want to interfere with that. But Clausen does recommend using a bead of caulk to seal threshold of exterior doors. Prevent hail damage. In 2018, there were 4,611 hailstorms across the country. My son-in-law had this happen. Boy, they damaged his car something awful. They can harm outdoor equipment and lead to water damage. If you live in a hail-prone area, use covers to shield essential gear. By the way, he's in Fort Worth, Texas. Such as your air conditioner, pool mechanicals, and grill. These covers can be made with solid plates or breathable mesh that doesn't interfere with functioning. They're sometimes referred to as armor top covers and can be purchased online for about $40. Do a tree and debris check. When a heavy tree limb goes in flying midstream, it can wreak havoc on your roof, windows, and a car. A trained arborist, look for your state's Arborist Association for leads, can check tree's location and health and recommend pruning or other action. You want to repeat this process every 3 years or so. The cost of professional tree trimming averages about $460, but varies greatly. Tree removal costs about $750, but can run as from $200 to $2,000 or higher. If, say, you have a gigantic old tree in a hard-to-reach spot, you may be able to cut a small branch safely and effectively yourself with a hand pruners or a telescopic pole saw. It is also important to have at least a 5-foot buffer around your home that's free from yard debris and dead plants. These are tremendous fire risks, says Ian Giannacoma, Ph.D., lead research meteorologist at the Insurance Institute for Business, Home, and Safety. Shield chimney openings. Few people want squirrels, bats, birds, and other wildlife taking up residence inside their home. Oh, come on. To keep out unwanted visitors, make sure chimneys are capped. Installing a cap typically costs about $300. Look for one that has wire mesh panels, says NAHB Klassen. A cap can also reduce the chances of embers drifting out of your chimney and starting a fire. How to Outsmart a Car Thief. Car thieves are on the rise, up 17% between 2019 and 2021, according to the National Insurance Crime Bureau. Take these steps to keep your car safe. Lock the doors every time. Unlocked doors are a major contributor to theft. Park in well-lit locations. If you keep your car outside, a motion-sensitive light nearby can help startle a thief and send them running. A visible security camera can also be a deterrent. Beef up security. Steering wheel locks, $20 to $100, and alarm systems with a visible blinking red light, $300 to $700, plus installation, can help discourage thieves. Most new cars seem to have those. Don't leave valuables in sight. A handbag, mobile phone, or laptop left on a seat or the vehicle's floor can invite smash-and-grab crimes. Protect your car's catalytic converter. Located on the underside of many vehicles, it typically contains precious metals such as platinum and is increasingly a target of thieves. A converter-specific alarm, around $30 and up, might be a good investment. Get a security system. The latest FBI statistics show an estimated annual loss of $3 billion due to burglaries, with an average loss of $2,600. But a security system can be a deterrent. At the University of North Carolina at Charlotte research involving 400-plus convicted burglars, about 60% of respondents said they would keep moving if a potential target had one. A security system might also save you 5 to 20% on your insurance premium, depending on how sophisticated it is. The word sophisticated, in fact, describes how this category is evolving. Artificial intelligence and video and analytics help cameras and sensors to better distinguish between, say, your dog chasing a squirrel and a burglar attempting to get in, says Elizabeth Parks, President and Chief Marketing Officer at Parks Associates, a technology research and consulting company. Today's system can also monitor for smoke and more. Do a perimeter check. Take a look at your home from the yard and street to see if you were a thief. Are there bushes you could hide behind and pry your way inside? Can you see valuables? Small moves like cutting back shrubs and closing curtains can help secure your property. Evaluate the entrances. Exterior doors should be metal or solid wood, at least 1 3/4 inches thick. Otherwise, they are too easy to bash in. Do you have a sliding patio doors? Do they lock well? If not, replace or secure them. Options include adhesive film that makes glass harder to break and rods to stop thieves from jimmying the doors. Make sure all windows and door locks are working, and use them. Deadbolts with pick-resistant cylinders are best for doors. The strike plate should be enforced, or it should give way with one good kick. Install outdoor lighting. Being bathed in light could send a potential burglar packing. Add motion sensor bulbs to fixtures near entrances. They're available at home centers and Amazon from about $18 for two. No electrician is required. Protect the inside of your home. While it's important to secure your home from the outside, the interior can benefit from a watchful electronic eye as well. Indoor monitoring can tell if there's any risk to loved ones or pets, or stop a problem before it starts and causes pricey damage. Put security cameras in the right spots. Seuss out the best locations for indoor cameras. If intruders are your top concern, you'll want to monitor the area they'll walk through first if they get inside your front and back door, i.e., the hallway or mudroom. Add cameras in rooms where your valuables are kept, such as areas where you display collections, have expensive electronics, or keep cash. For privacy reasons, it's best not to install cameras in bedrooms. Mounting a camera in a corner usually delivers the widest view. Just be careful not to aim it at a strong indoor or natural light, which can wash out the video and make it hard to see what's happening. Want to keep an eye on pets? Place a camera where they spend most of their time. If you have an older person living with you and you worry about falls, you might want to install an indoor camera to monitor your home staircase. Watch over the indoor environment. Smart thermostats such as our two top models, the Google Nest Learning Thermostat at $179 and the Honeywell Home T9 RCHT Thermostat $185, connect to a smartphone app allowing you to remotely control your home heating and cooling. This is convenient, and it can help you avoid disaster during unexpected cold snaps or heat waves while you're away. A temperature below 32 degrees Fahrenheit is most likely to lead to pipe damage, but you need to set your thermostat well above that level. Some experts suggest 65 degrees Fahrenheit or above to make sure that the area inside your walls where the pipes are which can be much colder than the exterior of your home and the interior of your home, stay at a safe temperature. A smart thermostat can also help you track heat and humidity. The Environmental Protection Agency recommends indoor humidity in the 30 to 50% range to avoid mold, mildew, and a bacteria growth, or the humid conditions, dust mites, a la allergen, are known to live in. Avoid likely leaks. A leak detector is like wearing a seatbelt, says Kirk McDowell, CEO of security consulting firm MacGuard Security Advisors. You don't realize its value until you need it. And you may well need it. About 1 in 60 insured homeowners file a water-related claim every year. These devices either measure the flow rate in pipes on your main water supply or detect water leaking into the floor. They can be put near or near your water heater, under sinks, by pipes that run to your washer, and near exterior walls that could freeze. The detectors can be a security system add-ons or purchased independently. They can notify you and possibly a central monitoring station of leaks, and some can even turn off the water. CR's tester, like the FlowSmart Water Monitor and Shutoff by Moen, 500 to 750, which must be professionally installed, and the Do-It-Yourself Guardian by Alexa Leak Prevention System, GVD3, $300 to $406. Don't let a thunderstorm fry your tech. Poof! One good lightning strike and your valuable computer and TV can sizzle their way out of service. Surge protectors are helpful, but GM Anonico recommends putting your most valuable device on an uninterruptible power supply, which is a bigger version of a power strip that looks like a black box. Prices range from around $50 to hundreds of dollars, depending on the type. If you live in an area known for frequent lightning storms, such as Central Florida, you might want to consider a whole home surge protector, a device that goes on your breaker box and costs around $500. Do a fire safety sweep. In 2021, a home fire was reported every 93 seconds in America, and a home fire injury occurred every 47 minutes. Help protect your home and loved ones by requiring all smoking to take place outside and having smokers douse butts to extinguish them, taking care not to leave a burning candle unattended, or moving a combustible material such as papers away from a space heater. And always turn off those off when you leave a room or go to bed, the American Red Cross says. Make sure you have an operational smoke and carbon monoxide detectors, such as CR's top-rated First Alert Smart Z Combo G, combination smoke and carbon monoxide detector for $55. Located in or near bedrooms, change the batteries whenever the clocks spring forward or fall back. Maintain HVAC systems. Have your heating, ventilating, and air conditioning systems inspected every year. The average cost is $75 to $200. It can help keep your system operating smoothly and economically. What's more, it can ward off damage, such as a fire from a furnace issue or water damage from your AC's condensate plan overflowing. Your home security toolkit. Cleaning your home secure starts with a sturdy lock on all entry points. A security system adds another level of protection, alerting you to a breach at any of those entries or to unexpected movement inside the house. A do-it-yourself system, such as those from Ring and Simple Safe, is fairly easy to set up and typically operates via an app on your mobile device, allowing you to monitor on the go. The equipment and starter kits for these systems vary slightly, but the kits generally include a base station, a keypad, and some combination of door and window sensors, motion sensors, and cameras. Some have a range extender to enhance coverage. Most systems also offer optional extras from panic buttons to glass break sensors to smoke and carbon monoxide monitors for about $35 to $40 each. You can also install smart wireless Wi-Fi enabled video cameras, a video doorbell, a thermostat, smoke and CO detectors, leak detectors, and more that are independent of a security system but still allow remote control. Cameras. Mount them about 8 to 10 feet up on indoor rooms near you want to catch near outdoor entry points in your garage or parking area. Entry sensors. These two-part sensors notify the system when the contact between the two sides of an is interrupted, indicating the door or window has been opened. Motion sensors. Most do-it-yourself systems come with at least one. Place it on the wall about 7 feet above the floor in an entry hall. Base station and keypads. The base station is the hub of the do-it-yourself system and requires a strong Wi-Fi signal to work properly. The keypads go near the main doors where you can use a code or arm or disarm the system as you come and go. And household sensors. Do-it-yourself systems offer extra options that can help you catch problems before they cause damage, including flood and freeze sensors, glass break sensors, and smoke and CO monitors. And here's a couple of them. DI security systems. These wireless setups are typically easy to install yourself without an electrician. They are sold as starter kits, and you could add more components and sensors a la carte. Some offer optional professional monitoring. The Ring Alarm Pro B08HST for $300 scored a 79 in this testing. SimpleSafe The Essentials SS3, $165, scored a 76. And Ring Alarm Security Set 4K19SZ, $299, scored a 74. Security cameras. Wireless security cameras connect to Wi-Fi and can be plugged in for power or run on a rechargeable battery. You monitor themself via a smartphone app. The first one is Arlo Essential Wireless Security VMC 2030, $80. Ring Stick Up Cam Battery, 3rd Generation, $73, scored to 70. Lorex 2K Pan Tilt Wi-Fi W46-2E Wireless Security Camera for $60, indoor only, scored to 74. Video doorbells. They offer all the features of a wireless security camera while also alerting you if someone rings the doorbell. You probably won't need an additional security camera covering the same door. SimpleSafe Doorbell SS3, $170, scored a 76. The Ring Video Doorbell, $140, scored a 74. And the TP-Link Casa Smart KD110, $73, scored a 68. Door locks. A high-security, drill-proof lock is the best option. New smart locks, also available in retrofit versions that add on to existing lock, offer convenience such as remote locking. High security. Medico Maxima 11603, $190, scored a 96. Smart lock, Eufy Smart Lock Touch and Wi-Fi, T8520, scored an 85. It's $260. And retrofit smart lock, Bosma Aegis Smart Lock SL0001 at $90, scored a 98. Do you need a pro-installed system? The security systems we test are kits that you buy and install yourself with basic tools. But you can also use a company that provides professionally installed systems such as ADT or Vivint to design a system for your home and install it. Here's how to decide which type is best. What's your budget? A professionally installed system is probably the more expensive option. I'd estimate $1 per square foot for an installed system that is monitoring all the doors and windows of your home with sensors, says Kirk McDowell, CEO of security consulting firm MacGuard Security. Video cameras will add to the cost. You're likely to pay between $15 and $30 per month for monitoring. A basic do-it-yourself setup will cost much less. But added components, door, window sensors, and cameras can easily drive that price up significantly as well. How big is your home? If you live in a smaller home with a simple layout, you may be fine with a do-it-yourself system. This can be a good solution for renters, too. But if you live in a home with, say, multiple entry points, sliding glass doors, a guest cottage or workshop out back, and other features that make it more challenging to monitor, you might do better with a professionally installed system. Do you want to monitor your system itself, yourself? A pro security system will come with a required monitoring for a monthly fee. So if an alarm goes off, it will alert the company's service, and they'll call emergency personnel. Most do-it-yourself systems offer monitoring and may require it for a fee each month, but some let you monitor your alerts yourself at no extra charge. Well, there are some more parts of the thing for this article in your house. It's insurance will be next, but we don't have enough time to finish that, so let's go ahead and close out with the most unusual things in each state that we started last week. We won't finish that either, but we can get a start. Connecticut, the Essex Steam Train. Catch an old-fashioned steam train chugging along the Valley Railroad in Essex. Essex Station was built in 1892 as the home base for a 12-mile loop of tracks. You can see the station, as well as the steam engine and vintage coaches, working their way through the nearby towns of Deep River and Chester. Delaware, Our Lady Queen of Peace Shrine. Check out this 33-foot stainless steel statue of the Virgin Mary in the Art Gallery at Holy Spirit Church in Newcastle. The church says Our Lady Queen of Peace statue, which was designed and sculpted by Charlie Parks, was built to remind us of Mary's love for all her children and to offer us hope for peace throughout the world. The statue is visible to those traveling along the Delaware Memorial Bridge in Ernest Day. Actually, I think I read that last week. I'm sorry. I do remember because I remember I've never seen it. How about Idaho, the Spud Drive-In Theater? Why wouldn't you find a drive-in named after a potatoes in a state known for its great spuds? At the Spud Drive-In Theater in Driggs, a potato farming region of Idaho, visitors are greeted by a giant potato in the back of a 1946 Chevrolet truck. Built in 1953, the drive-in shows feature films on Fridays and Saturdays. Illinois, it's the Abe Lincoln Rail Splitter statue, and boy, this is a cheapy-looking statue. It's no surprise to find a statue of a U.S. President Abraham Lincoln in the city of Springfield, Illinois. But this one, where he lived, raised his children, and was buried. But this one is 30 feet tall, even taller than a 19-foot statue at the Lincoln Memorial, and is carved without his iconic beard. This clean-shaven version of a young Lincoln stands at Gate 1 of the Illinois State Fairgrounds, built in 1968, and is named the Rail Splitter. Geography buff? Indiana, the world's largest paintball. At this fun roadside attraction in Alexandria, visitors can add their own coat of paint to the world's largest paintball. What started as a regular-sized baseball now weighs more than 4,000 pounds, have some 2,300 layers of paint. Mike and Glenda Carmichael of Alexandria started the project more than 40 years ago, and since then has been listed in the Guinness World of World Records. And Iowa has the world's largest Swedish coffee pot. Who wouldn't want to get their photo taken next to the world's largest Swedish coffee pot? This former water tower in Stanton is now painted with decorative flowers and hearts and can hold 800,000 cups of coffee. One more tie to coffee for this town? The actress who played Mrs. Olson in the Folgers coffee commercials happens to be from Stanton. And a couple of giggles before we close out. During my sixth grade language arts class, the topic of rhetorical appeals came up. I mentioned that the idea comes from the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle. Later, as I went over their notes, I was pleased to see that at least one student had paid attention. He'd written that rhetorical appeals were the creation of one Mr. Eric Stottle. Client to graphic artists. We really like your illustration style, very artisty, but we don't feel you can put a price on art. So can you do it for free? And the best man for the job. Apple, uncertified genius. Led remote tech support for older family members throughout the country. Once put off a software update for over 8 months. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.